You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store.
I'm Sam Edwards. I'm third generation cure master from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Foods USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at SurreyFarms.com or VirginiaTraditions.com.
Welcome to Why We Cook on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Erica Weitz, your host. And so the summer ends. Feels like it today. I mean, not officially, of course. But, you know, really, doesn't Labor Day always kind of feel like the end of summer to you? I went outside for a run yesterday in Prospect Park, and there were maple leaves starting to turn red and fall down. Yeah, it feels sort of like the end. I saw my first pumpkins at the farmer's market this weekend. Not in the city, upstate, but still. You know, there's lots of apples coming in right now. It's definitely, you know, it's there. You can feel it. And I even, you know, I woke up this morning with that, like, back to school anxiety. Because that day after Labor Day to me is always back to school. Even though I've been out of school for more than two decades now. Almost three decades. But I don't know if you ever outgrow that. I don't know. You know, I woke up with that feeling. And I spent the whole weekend with my family. The long weekend was spent up at the wee tiny bungalow with the family. And, you know, that sort of had that feel to it, too, like end of the summer, get the whole family together. And, you know, we did what we did best, which is sit around and eat, mostly. We did a lot of eating. It's sort of, I think, it's how we communicate. And I think a lot of families are like that. You do your best when you're sitting over a meal, and especially if there's some beer involved. But it was like definitely like one of those end of summer blowout meals. Like you really felt like this was a meal that we're going to make now, and we're not going to have this kind of meal again until next summer. I had scored some really nice duck breasts from work, from a fabrication class, and so I had these duck breasts. And then on Friday we went to the farmer's market and we got sweet corn and big stack of rainbow chard and a big pile of green beans. And, you know, we were all set to cook that because I thought that the garden had gotten totaled in the hurricane and I had kind of just written that off. And then when we got up there on Friday night or Saturday morning, I went down to check out the garden. I took my niece down there with me. And I was shocked to see that it had, like, had a resurrection. For some reason, the hurricane didn't destroy the garden. It gave it like this growth spurt, like it came back. Instead of being pounded to pulp and being drowned, everything kind of sprung back into action. And I got like a whole new batch of green beans and okra. And it was like a starting over. And my sister actually said that the crocuses in their yard had started to come up after the hurricane, too, which was really weird. I mean, maybe it was the amount of rain, like the plants thought, you know, oh, it's spring or something. But, and it's funny because 2 weeks ago, I almost pulled out all my green bean plants thinking, well, that's it. That was, you know, that's over. But they seem to have kind of had a little resurrection. So they're like the Jesus of beans or something. But anyway, so my niece and I, we picked all those beans and we made this amazing end of the summer feast. It was sort of, you know, end of the summer, but not really because we still have a month to go. But it felt like it sort of felt like an end. So I got these duck breasts. And so I, you know, I cooked them really slowly, like with the skin down. I've talked about this before. I had to cook a duck breast. Like You put the skin side down in a saute pan, very low heat, no extra fat. And you just render so that skin gets really crispy. So that's what I did. And then I made a glaze in the pan from some of my very precious Crown Heights Brooklyn honey, which we were just tasting here in the studio, and some lemon juice. So I was talking about that last week, that, you know, honey lemon cough drop vinaigrette, and I'm still kind of stuck in that little flavor rut. So I poured that over the duck, and I served it all up nice and pink and medium rare and juicy. And we're still eating this giant batch of tomato jam that I had made because students were doing knife skills and chopping up all these tomatoes. So I had taken those and cooked that up. And so I served that. And it really just tasted like summer. It was like this concentrated summer essence meal. And we had these green beans that were tossed with basil and red onions. And the corn was like, you know, super sweet corn. And, you know, it was one of those sweet, fleeting moments that seem to come at the end of summer. It's like you reach this point at the end of the summer where it seems almost like everything's in suspended animation. Like everything's ripe and just starting to end, and then it's Labor Day. And then it seems like the weather changes overnight, and that's it. And now it is. It's like 60-something degrees here in New York today and raining, and that's what happens. And I don't want to, you know, I don't mean to sound maudlin or emotional, but time passes by, and things change, and the seasons go around, and you can embrace it and try to hold on to it, or you can mourn it, but it still goes. You know, my cute little niece, who was a toddler 5 minutes ago, is 12. And I've been the owner of the little tiny bungalow now for 10 years. And one of my best friends is turning 50, when in my mind she's 27, and, you know, I'm 23. And that's what happens. Time passes. Things change. And one of the reasons we were all together up at the bungalow this weekend was that my mom had come up from Florida to visit. And she came, of course, to see us, but she also came up to visit one of her oldest friends, her friend Bernice. And Mike and Bernice were friends of my parents since I was born, basically, since I was about a year old. And I spent many, many nights of my childhood going there for dinner. They were very good friends of the family. And he died last year. I think he was at least 90, maybe older. And she is now in her late 80s, and she's in a nursing home because she has Parkinson's. But they were very dynamic people when I, you know, as I remember them when they were young. And if she didn't have Parkinson's, she would be like Betty White. You know, she'd be still going nonstop. But they were two of the people who influenced me the most. I would have to say they're up there in like the top five influential people in my life as that influence pertained to food, to exposing me to really good, really high quality, sophisticated food in my youth, in my childhood. They were both very, very good cooks and bakers, both of them. And, you know, we're very sophisticated about food. You know, way back. I mean, back when, you know, in the 70s, when other friends' families would have us over for dinner and we would be, you know, eating 1970s supermarket processed food, you know, frozen green beans and, you know, just nothing. They were making, you know, their own bread and braising coq au vin and making homemade rugelach and, you know, like really serious cooks. And they were really, really into food and really into cooking and baking. And because of that, I always liked to go to their house. And I was always, you know, impressed and inspired. And it was always sort of exciting to go to their house for dinner because I knew we were going to eat things that were really pretty sophisticated and, you know, kind of high end. And they always kind of encouraged me in that way and taught me stuff. And, you know, I remember like someone had given me a little pastry bag when I was a little kid. And I remember Mike showing me how to use it because his grandfather had been a baker. He taught me how to use the pastry bag. And so I feel like I was exposed to a level of cooking of quality and care in food that I didn't necessarily see in other places back then. You know, this was in the era of Julia Child and the sort of early days of the food awakening in the U.S., but it was also heavily into the like recession era processed, frozen, packaged, you know, casserole days too. And so, you know, even at home, we were eating and cooking like more like them and less like the processed stuff, but we had less money than them. So, you know, there were corners cut and we did it on a, you know, a slightly sort of cheaper scale. And then of course my parents got divorced and we were like sort of floundering around living on Diet Coke and Lean Cuisine there for a while as we all kind of fell apart and pulled it all back together. So going over to their house was always like this nice kind of stability moment and treat. And over the years, they had collected the, or I guess subscribed to the Time Life Good Cook series. And so if you don't know what those are, Time Life books were put out, you know, these big collections throughout the probably 60s through the 90s. And I'm sure you've heard of, you know, there are hundreds of them, different ones about science fiction and geography and science, all this kind of stuff. But Time Life put out this series called the Good Cook series for about 20 years. And they're this amazing set of books. There's probably 25 or 30 of them, and they cover the entire scope of cooking techniques and ingredients and like seriously everything. And you would subscribe and you would get, you know, like once a month or something. And they're out of print now. They don't make them anymore. You have to find them used. And so if you ever get a set or if you come across a set, you should buy them. They're sold used very cheaply still. But they're a great resource. And they have these step-by-step photos in them. And they're just really good. And so when I was a little kid, I'd go over there and I would always kind of look through them. And, you know, I found them really interesting and I was always eyeing them. And so Bernice used to say to me, oh, you know, those are yours. You know, when the time comes, you get those books. And so over the course of the past probably 10 years, I actually had started collecting them because I would find them in used bookstores. And I found a whole bunch of them somewhere. And I actually one day found a whole stack of them on the street. And so I have a lot of them. But last year when she moved into a nursing home, she gave me her whole set, like the whole entire set complete. So I gave away a lot of my doubles and I have them on my shelf right behind my desk, and I use them and I, you know, think about these people in my life who were very influential and sort of showed me a whole other kind of level of cooking and way of looking at food, and sort of love and passion for feeding people and entertaining, and, you know, how they had two sons and so they always saw us, I think, as, you know, like their substitute daughters. And so, you know, glad that I had them in my life. And it was sad to see her in this nursing home, and she's old and frail. Anyway, sorry, getting sort of sad and maudlin here again. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll move on. I say no, you say stop, and I say go. Welcome back to Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. Jack's going to make me cry listening to that song. I'm not going anywhere. Just changing. Hello and goodbye. Exactly. And I do love that song. Anyway, welcome back to Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Erica Weitz, your host. So I was talking in the last segment about seeing this old friend of the family, she's a very, very old friend of my mother's. And, you know, I was thinking about this last night that I went to see her with my mom on Labor Day. And that also struck me as kind of profound because she was a teacher you know, career teacher. Her husband was a career teacher. My father was a career teacher. Many of their friends were teachers. And now I'm a teacher, too. Not just, you know, in my where I teach, but I think in other ways of my life. But those guys, my father and his friends, they were the first generation of teachers to unionize. Before them, the New York City and the Long Island public school teachers did not have a union, and they were the ones who unionized, and they were the ones to fight for that first labor contract. And that kind of struck me because it was Labor Day yesterday, and actually I am on the committee that's negotiating our new contract where I work right now, and we actually just finished negotiating today our contract, so that seemed fitting also because it's Labor Day. But so I was thinking about that, you know, there are people right now in the U.S. who really, really oppose organized labor. They are very opposed to unions and labor unions, and they want to take away people's rights to collective bargaining. You know about this in Wisconsin. And I don't have to tell you all of this, of course, because you are Heritage Radio listeners, and you're smart and rational and know that people have fought and died in this country for their labor rights. And to take those away, I think, is a national shame and embarrassment. And I think that we should be rising up in a revolution to protect people like our teachers and our nurses and our tradespeople and all the other unionized workers out there. Now, I know that unions have not always done the right thing, and there's been corruption and there's been abuses of power, and it's not always been the best thing. But really, I mean, would you rather your child's teacher be part of a powerful union and be protected and have rights, or would you rather they not? Think about it. Now, except, ironically, the union I do not support is the Hotel and Restaurant Workers Union, which is a very corrupt and irrelevant union and doesn't really help our field actually much at all. But that's a whole other show sometime, perhaps. But I really hope that those people out there who are trying to kill organized labor and take away the rights of people to collective bargaining enjoyed their day off yesterday, or enjoy their 40-hour work week or their disability insurance or their 5-day week or all the other things that people have fought and given their lives for in the name of your rights as a worker. And this has nothing to do with why we cook. You may be wondering, what is going on here? Why is she talking about this? Except for that it's, you know, sort of a look into my past and what formed me and the events that shaped me and who I am and what I've become. I sort of grew up in this very pro-union household and understanding that that sort of stuff was really important. And so maybe it's got everything to do with why we cook, because these are the sort of events and stories and things that shaped me and made me who I am. My crazy childhood with the stories that I've told you about, like the coal-burning stove in suburban Long Island and all that kind of wacky stuff. The pickle room. I'm sure I've talked about the pickle room in my house. And so in these past 98 episodes of Why We Cook, we've gone into some of that and how that shaped who I am as a teacher and as a cook. And also the people who I was exposed to who were very influential in my development as a cook and a teacher, like Bernice. So this is the 99th episode of Why We Cook, in case you've been counting. And when I was presented the opportunity to do this amazing opportunity to do this show for this network 2.5 years ago, you know, of course I pounced on it. And I thought a lot about what I wanted the show to be. You know, I wanted it to be about food. I originally thought it would be sort of a virtual cooking school, sort of a, you know, cooking school on air. But I also wanted it to be about not just cooking, but about eating and history and anthropology and things that sort of went beyond cooking. You know, a way of kind of delving into what drives us to cook, what compels us to cook, what makes us cook, what we do cook. And I had just read a book by Richard Wrangham, who is a guy at Harvard, called Catching Fire, How Cooking Made Us Human. And after I read that book, I sort of came up with this idea for the show, because in his book, he theorizes or poses this theory that what really set us apart from our ape-like ancestors, what, you know, sort of gave us that final leap from the ape-like humans to being true humans, was that we figured out how to capture fire, how to harness it. And because of that, we figured out how to cook our food. And because we cooked our food, we were able to consume a lot more of it and a lot more protein, because we didn't spend all day sitting around trying to chew up raw meat. We were suddenly able to take in much larger amounts of protein. And because of that, we developed these big brains. And with these big brains, we developed things, you know, like tools and government and labor unions and the Tea Party and artificially flavored drinks and all those other things, and agriculture and farming and everything happened because we harnessed fire and started cooking. And it all goes back to that. So, but cooking also did something else, which is that it socialized us and civilized us, because we suddenly had to work much more cooperatively in order to get the food and organize food and get the fire going and cook the food. And it also forced us to kind of sit down and eat and look each other in the eyes and be civil, because we weren't just grabbing whatever we could find as soon as we killed it and eating it out in the field. We were bringing it back to the hearth, basically. And so cooking made us human, and that's what his book is about, and it's as simple as that. And, you know, we're the only creatures who do it. We're the only mammals that do it. We're the only members of the animal kingdom who cook our food, although fewer and fewer of us are actually doing it now, despite the enrollment in culinary schools, which seems to keep going up, although not many of those people are actually cooking either. So that's what I wanted the show to be about originally. From that first harnessing a fire by early man to, you know, the crazy out there experimental cuisine of the modernists happening now, and, you know, everything that happened in between. You know, what literally made us cook to what still drives us to put food on fire, because that's what it's all about, just putting, you know, food and fire together. And so I deliberately left it very loose and very wide open so I could do things like celebrate the, you know, the anniversary of the Easy Bake Oven, you know, or celebrate the death and life of the inventor of the cheese doodle, or go into depth about, you know, homely root vegetables like turnips, or talk about my love of bitterness. I kind of wanted it to be freeform and wide open, you know, or do a show all about skin, or a show about how swimming made me realize that cooking food is all just about water, you know, or my experience teaching cooking to Vietnamese orphans. And then relate it all back in a convoluted but eventually round trip way back to the destination. And it's been great, and I love it, and I love doing the show. And, you know, some weeks have been better than others. Some weeks I couldn't think of anything to talk about, and so I just complained. And I could probably go on and do another 99 or 100 episodes. But it's time to move on. And remember what I was saying earlier in the show about a revolution and how I think it's time for the revolution? Well, I feel like we're due for revolutions on so many levels, not just in, of course, organized labor and politics and the way that, you know, corporate America is destroying this country and horrible, evil, right-wing rich people are stepping on everybody, but in food. And how food is produced and how it's marketed and how it's sold to us. And I think we're already beginning that revolution. I mean, there are amazing things happening in the world of food right now. The farm-to-table movement, you know, having Michelle Obama plant a garden in the White House, you know, urban farming, locavores, farmers markets, urban chickens, Edible Magazine, all of that is great. And I love it, and I'm a big part of it. But I feel like it only speaks to just a few people in a sort of small, somewhat elite subculture, you know, the people who for whatever reason have chosen to seek that out. And there's a whole lot of people out there who are alienated from that, and who I think, because they're alienated from it, are turning against it or rejecting it, when they're really the people who it could be helping the most. And at the same time that that's going on, corporate America has been, you know, listening at the door. They have their ear to the barn door. They're not stupid. And they want in on the party. And they are doing their damnedest to get their share of the big organic green apple pie. And they want you to believe that they have your best interests at heart and that they really believe that their so-called wellness initiatives are really about wellness. And that's what's really firing me up these days. I feel like, as in labor, as with teachers, as with all other change that's happened, too many people have worked too hard for too long to change our food system that we can allow the industrialized mega corporations to co-opt our movement. They can't have it. Okay, we've all worked way too long and too hard, and I don't want them to have it. So, as I've been saying for quite a few months now leading up to this, Why We Cook is going to change. And, you know, I'm sad to see it go. I mean, I love my kind of freewheeling ruminations on, you know, skin and bitterness and leather and dirt. But that's not going away. But I'm also really excited about the new show, which I'll be premiering next week. I'll still incorporate all that weird and wacky stuff, but it's going to change a little bit. I've been working on the new show for a long time, and I think you'll really like it too. You know, I'll still keep it funny, and it'll still be fun and full of all the little crazy food trivia and tidbits and facts and, you know, stuff about beaver ass glands and artificial vanilla and all that. But there's an agenda now, and I think the time is right, and the political and cultural climate are right and right there. And if there's any place to have a show like this, it's here on Heritage Radio, here in the back of Roberta's, here in post-industrial Brooklyn, where there's vegetables growing on the roof and, you know, bees outside. So it's the end of Why We Cook, but it's the beginning of a whole new world. That sounds a little dramatic. So next week at the same time, 6:30, next Tuesday night, I'll be premiering the first episode of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. And if you don't want to eat shit, I suggest you listen to it. So we'll be back, same time as always, and you can still find all the Why We Cook episodes on iTunes. And you can still be a fan on Facebook. I'm going to start a new page for Let's Get Real. There's going to be a new website. It's letsgetrealshow.com. The Heritage Radio Network website will reflect the change in the show. It's still me. It's still going to be here. Just things are going to change a little bit. So I'm really excited about it. I feel like this is a new beginning. It's a, you know, start the school year off right. I still think of September as the beginning of the year. I don't think that'll ever change for me. So hopefully you'll listen and you'll let me know what you think. I love hearing from all of you all the time. I love when you leave comments and get in touch with me. And I'm curious to see what people think. I even have a new theme song. I'm excited about that. So we'll see you next week. Same time, 6:30. And we'll get real.
This is a message from Fork and Anchor. Aaron Fitzpatrick, the host of our wine program, Unfiltered, is looking for help on Kickstarter to open Fork and Anchor, a general store inspired by two food-loving ladies with an equal affection for urban life, the sea, and the agricultural paradise of Long Island's North Fork. The store is situated in a growing community of farmers and winemakers and will become a meeting place offering prepared foods, a variety of sun-dries, and a selection of homespun products, many of which will have their origins in New York State. Your backing will help them fulfill their dream of fostering relationships with the community and making the local food system accessible on a broader scale. Search Kickstarter.com for Fork and Anchor and donate today. The following is a message from NOFA NY.
Do you dig local food? Love organic farmers? Do you crave to be part of a growing movement of consumers concerned with the state of our nation's food system? Then sign up today to take the NOFA NY's Locavore Challenge this September. Join 5,000 other New York locavores that are hungry, active, and ready to change our food system. Learn more at www.nylocavorechallenge.com.
Every spring at the end of kidding season, goat dairies across the country are faced with the question of what to do with their male bucklings. Because on a dairy farm, there's no role for a male. Often, the most economical thing for these farmers to do is to cull the animals at birth or ship them off to the commodity market. Heritage Foods USA is embarking on a new project, No Goat Left Behind, looking to step in and fill this niche by creating a marketplace for these male bucklings. Visit us at www.heritagefoodsusa.com to learn more and to reserve your goat this coming October.